there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your hair. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there.
Welcome to On the Wing podcast presented by Purina Pro Plan. We just got done with the Dime Tour, right? We're recording live today at Predictix. What the heck is Predictix? Well, you're going to have to stick around, listen. That's one of the nuggets you're going to learn about on today's episode of On the Wing podcast. Got a trifecta, a hat trick, if you will, of topics on the agenda for today's episode. First off, we're going to talk about started bird dogs. Then we're going to roll into weather. You're going to get your weather report for bird country, pheasant and quail country. And then we'll wrap this up with a little conversation about what you probably saw just a few days, well, about 2 weeks ago now. The brand new refreshed logos, brand identities for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. So we got a full agenda coming at you. And to help break down these topics with me, welcoming back to the podcast, the brains behind the Rooster Road Trip, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's Vice President of Marketing, Andrew Vavra. I say the brains behind the road trip. I got to ask you, because people are here road tripping, like, where are they going next year? You going to tease them with anything?
I wish I could, but I don't know. I can tell you it'll be later in the year. It'll be somewhere in the continental United States of America. But yeah, I'm glad to be back. I can certainly help break you down, Bob. It's been so long. I was worried that I like offended you and your pack of German poor hairs. So here we are.
Wow. Welcome in Todd Nelson to the conversation from Predictix. Feel free to defend me because right. Andrew can take swings very easily. Would you call them German poor hairs?
Well, now that I've got a German wire hair, I understand the true value of a nice sleek coat.
I've not heard that before. Is that a thing? German poor hairs?
I don't think it is, but we can make it one. I mean, they're one of the most popular breeds out there. I mean, right behind the lab, and everybody understands why. But, you know, it's just like you want to knock down who's on top. So you guys have a target on your back.
And
it's well-deserved.
I definitely feel the target. You mentioned you have a German wire hair. So if folks it's 15 years of Rooster Road Trip, right?
Yeah,
this will be 16. I think.
16, sure.
So, if folks have followed along, they've seen you progress from a yellow Labrador, Bo, to the gentleman
Baxter,
an Epignol Breton,
yep.
A French Brittany. Tell us about your new pup, the wire hair, the German wire hair, as opposed to the poor hair.
I mean, if we're going to get into it to that level, I prefer wild hair. but no, actually, on one of our Rooster Road Trip podcasts this past fall, I alluded to maybe having, you know, something with a beard for the next season if everything worked out.
I wonder how many breeds have beards?
Poodle pointer, I mean, draughts are kind of the same thing as wire hairs.
There's wire haired Vizslas, Griffons. Yeah. There's probably, I don't know, maybe 10.
Yeah, there's a few of them for sure.
Sorry. Anyways.
Nope. But everything did work out in a pretty magical way, and I'll certainly get to that. But I am now the proud father of Merle the girl. And the events in which she came to my life were pretty serendipitous. So, you know, I have Bo, my yellow lab, which you mentioned, and that was the more traditional get her at, you know, 8 weeks old, raise up the puppy and do that whole thing. I was only 22 when I got her, so she raised me more than I raised her.
And you were hardcore waterfall hunter.
I mean, at that point, I was still primarily like a duck and deer guy. I mean, I just started to like scratch that upland itch, but you know, I started at Pheasants Forever as an intern. I didn't have a dog. So it was a lot easier for me to get out in a duck boat or sit in a tree stand. But once I saw the allure of it and the relationships that people had with their dogs like you, I was like, okay, there's something here. I want this as well. So she's the one that kind of broke the wheel for me in terms of I wanted to get a lab because I wanted something that could excel in the water and also hunt upland birds. Well, she told me that she preferred to upland hunt. And you know, once you're a dog father, you want to make your kid happy. So it's like, okay, we can pivot. We can focus on upland. And that's how I truly fell in love with upland hunting and the landscapes and the cool spots that it really brings you to. Because in my duck hunting days, I had my honey holes, I had, you know, my milk run, and you kind of get just used to the same spots. And not that I didn't enjoy getting up at, you know, 1 a.m. to go try and beat people to the spots. The upland world was just a lot more entertaining and a lot more liberating. And so I owe falling in love with that lifestyle to that dog.
Do you have a single moment that stands out related to Bo? Because I ask because I do. And you got to know exactly which one I'm talking about.
I don't have like a single moment that really stands out as like, no, that was like the epitome of us or anything like that. At this point, I mean, she still is like that dog for me, where it's just like everything about our relationship. And maybe that comes with the fact that, you know, we kind of raised each other and had that type of bond. Like everything was special, but it's all just kind of like a blur at this point. So when I go and look back at photos, it's like, oh yeah, that's right. And this is where you did that dumb thing. And I missed that bird and all that. So nothing like stands out in terms of like hunting, but I mean, she chewed through drywall. She absolutely destroyed my parents' formal dining living room table.
Todd's thinking about a dog.
There's plenty of moments for sure. But as far as like my journey with dogs goes, I mean, I was so young that I sent her away for her first summer to a kennel in Missouri, and they did a lot of the key foundational training and all that, and then I actually sent her back a following summer because I did my best raising a dog in an urban environment. And so for folks who might know the Minneapolis St. Paul area, I mean, I was living downtown Minneapolis, like literally downtown. Then I moved to uptown, and then I moved to Stillwater. So in terms of like raising a bird dog and finding places to train, I was the guy out at Biddy Makaska, if you know that lake, like throwing dummies at the beach while everyone else is trying to, you know, get their tan on and their vitamin D in their lives. But I also knew I had limitations and I was intimidated by it. So I farmed out that work, and I don't regret that at all. But when she started getting older, I had a family friend reach out and say, you know, a dog that came out of a litter that I produced, its owner died, and the widow just can't handle him. And I know that Bo's getting older, and you've been hinting that, you know, it's probably time to add dog number two to the pack just so you can have that transition. And I said, sure, I'll go take a look. But I mean, everyone knows the second you go take a look at a dog, like it's happening. And so that's when the gentleman Baxter entered my life. And he was touted as being started. I was told that this dog had hunted Nebraska and like had a really good foundation underneath him, and all that was a lie. Like
it wasn't a lie. It was an embellishment.
It was a heavily embellished statement. Because at that point, I knew kind of what a started dog, you know, in air quotes, looked like and like what to expect. And it's just like, this is still a work in progress. He was almost three already. So again, I tried to utilize the help of professional trainers just because I felt like I was kind of up against the eight ball. And like when you work at Pheasants Forever, right or wrong, you feel pressure to be able to open, you know, kick down the tailgate and have something come out of the kennel that like doesn't embarrass you a little bit if we're just being like really raw and truthful. When I got him back, they refused to take my money. Straight up, they're like, I'll tell you what, this guy is a heck of an athlete. He loves the pull. He is the ultimate rotor. But we're not going to charge you for any birds. We're not going to. I was just like, oh, lordy, lord. Oh, okay, well, I appreciate, you know, your assistance and really, really trying. But from that point on, I did my best with him. And I did, you know, the weekly training with our group here in Minnesota. And he just kind of was what he was. But he was such a free spirit and such a lovable, like, awesome dog.
Lovable, yeah.
That he was, like, the perfect Muppet slash, like, mascot just to, like, mm-hmm. have their blowing up everybody else's points because, like, you couldn't get mad at him, right?
Right.
And so having him and not regretting that for a moment, in the back of my mind, it's always like, okay, next dog, doing the puppy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing it right. Like, I know kind of like the attributes I'm looking for. Like, let's get serious now. This is going to be dog number three. You only have so many dogs in your life. Like, enough messing around.
Mm.
But unfortunately, Baxter got very, very sick and like suddenly, and he just couldn't
at six, right? Is that right?
Set six, seven ish. Yeah.
So way too, young.
Way too early. Basically his body was just urinating out protein nonstop. He couldn't keep on weight. Did a bunch of tests, couldn't figure it out, put him on the meds, and it just kept on escalating. And then unfortunately he passed away late last summer, like heading into the season. So that's why I was, you know, mooched the pooch during road trip last year and all of my hunts. I just had to annoy my friends to like allow me just to tag along because I didn't have any dog power to contribute. But when that happened, a very good friend reached out to me, and some of you may follow her on Instagram. Hope she doesn't mind me doxing her here.
What's the term? Doxing?
Doxing.
I've not heard that before.
Well, I'm going to dox her.
Have you heard that term?
We'll find out.
That's basically when you give away someone's information online.
Oh.
It's just like outing yourself because some people like to
showing
keep
my it. Age. Yeah. Doxing.
I'm
familiar with trolling.
I'll create
right.
I'll help you create a Reddit account eventually. It'll be fine. But you know, Katie Willis, traveling pup on Instagram. She's been a great friend to both me and my wife. For a while, and she just immediately reached out when she heard the news that Baxter passed, and she's like, listen, like this is awful. I've got your back in terms of I'm going to be traveling around with, you know, three young dogs all fall, and depending on how things shake out, like one of them could potentially be yours if you're interested. And that was an amazing gesture and one that I was immediately excited about, but I knew that could cause problems at home because at that point we still had a cat, a much older cat, and German Wirehairs have a lot of prey drive. You know, that breed, as it was in development, like in Europe, like part of the deal was not only will they point birds and help you find birds, they're also going to take out the predators that are, you know, taking out nests. So there's kind of like a combo deal. That's why they have fur drive, like that's why that's innately in them. So there was that, and then my wife, having been madly in love with Baxter, like me, was kind of more back on the Brittany train. We weren't going to go French, but we're leaning towards American, something a little more leggy and something that, you know, could definitely handle retrieves, because that's something that I learned through Baxter, is like dropping a bird and not having confidence in your dog's ability to help you get that bird.
Yeah.
That's a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
And I kind of got tired of like sprinting after birds and hoping that I'd be able to find it and maybe hoping that he'd point dead. So a strong desire to retrieve and something that could actually fit a pheasant in its mouth. Sorry, French Brittany fans, but you know, sometimes that's just, it's physically not possible.
Those big Kansas roosters.
Yeah, exactly. You know, go down to Nebraska. They put it all on their trucker hats. We were thinking probably American Brit, if we were being honest with ourselves.
And you were thinking puppy to connect it back to.
I was thinking puppy. Yep, exactly. But when Katie reached out with that opportunity, I was like, well, at that point, we still had a two-year-old son at home. The cat was kind of on its way out, which is super sad and unfortunate. But like, so that wasn't necessarily going to be a barrier to entry for a new dog. And although in my wife got on board because it was Katie, and because my wife didn't want to start a dog because there's a perception that if you get a started dog, it's going to grow up on a concrete pad. It's going to run the same 10 acres nonstop. and you're just going to get a machine. Mm-hmm. Like there's not going to be like a lot of like love and personality.
Right.
Like,
that was the thing that in my mind is like, oh, you miss the bonding piece.
Yep. And so knowing that, well, if this works out, this dog will have traveled with Katie for an entire season. When I'm talking an entire season, I'm talking 6-7 different states for 100 plus days, mm-hmm. in the back of a camper van with her pack of wild hairs, with her loving it up. Like, it was going to have that type of like already exposure. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what allowed Allie to be like, okay, we can go the started dog route. But to get to your kind of inquiry and like what you're wondering about, that breed to me, not having like a ton of like personal exposure to it, it seemed gruff. It seemed.
So as you're bringing this dog into your home?
I'm saying the breed in general, like it did, like just yep. the way they look, like they're kind of mean, lean, like they're kind of badass looking dogs, but like that they don't give off this like
cuddly vibe.
Like, mm-hmm. So in the back of my mind, I was like, well, I've had a lover of a lab. I've had a lover of a Muppet and a French Brit. And now we're going like perhaps the exact opposite end
with
of this.
What's Mason now? Three-year-old?
Three-year-old. Yep. And I got a three-year-old at home. Like, how's this like really going to work out? But obviously we went for it. And this dog is more of a Velcro dog than any dog I've
really?
Ever had.
Really?
Yeah. She is an absolute lover. Like it's shocking. Like she is always up in my business. She's always demanding like attention in like a lovable way. Like she just wants to cuddle. Mm. And it's like, this is not what I was expecting out of you. Like, I mean, she's still got plenty of drive, but mm-hmm. like the ability to still bond with the dog and have a really genuine personal relationship with that dog is not absent from started dogs. Mm. So I having done this now twice in terms of taking on dogs that weren't mine in the first stages, in their foundational stages of life, it's never once been an issue. Mm-hmm. It's like once you guys start feeling each other out and you get over kind of like the anxiety and the excitement of like new home and new people and new routines, you know, a couple months pass and it's like peanut butter and jelly. Mm-hmm. And so there are lots of reasons to delay getting dogs, whether it's like young kids, demanding career, and like the idea of a puppy can be maddening because mm-hmm. the idea of having a puppy and a 2-year-old at home at the same time, the 2-year-old is already waking me up at night enough. Like mm-hmm. that could be a lot and that mm-hmm. can cause resentment and problems in relationships. Like, well, the started dog that was delivered that's already trained to be very quiet in the kennel, that can expedite you being able to get a dog, right? So don't be bashful about started dogs at all. I think there's a lot of different ways to bring a dog into your life, and you need to be honest with yourself in terms of what station you're at and what's going to allow you and your family unit to thrive, because hunting season only lasts so long. And there's pros and cons to everything.
So kind of a combo platter question. How much do you believe is the individual dog that sets up, you know, how quickly they bond and, you know, how they react with owners? And then the other piece of that is how much, and I know your sample size is relatively small, nurture versus nature. Like, you know, that Merle was with Katie and a pack of dogs and loving, like, very social environment versus a started dog that's maybe raised on a, you know, on a trailer with 16 other dogs for a hunting season and then sold for a higher dollar amount. So kind of a two-part question there. What do you think is your evaluation of those elements?
I mean, if we're doing Olympic grading where you remove like kind of both ends of the spectrum and kind of like focus on like the middle a little bit, I do think it's nurture. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's cases, I mean, every dog's an individual, I get that. And there's cases where if you are spending $10,000+ on a field trial line mm-hmm. dog, that's going to have a lot of energy and its priority is going to be
finding
sticks,
birds.
Tennis balls, birds, nonstop, and that's gonna be tougher to like mm-hmm. get that relationship with because they're so hyper focused. Like, I get that, but really it's nurture, and mm-hmm. I think it's up to the owners to bring that out and to create that safe pack mentality where it's just like, I love you, man. Like, and you love me, and like, we're in this together, and like, let's, like, it's okay. Cause dogs are so smart. They, they pick up on nonverbal cues cause they can't speak English. They're reading you. Like, they're, if they get that vibe from you, that you're that type of human, I think they'll be reciprocal, because what dog doesn't like getting a scratch in the back of the ears, a pat on the butt, and like sneaking up on the couch here and
don't
there.
We all
like, it's like we all like affirmation, whether it's words or actions. Everybody's got a love language, so it's just like breaking that down with the dog. I do think it's just up to the owner to bring that out.
I also think it's super cool that you have such a tight relationship with Katie, because if you just brought Merle home, they're like, do we use come or here? You know, like all the daily commands, like your ability to ask, hey, like, he's acting sort of weird when I give him a carrot. What's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, Katie has spoiled me rotten. Before I even picked her up, she had started filming herself with Merle in terms of here's how I trim Merle's nails.
Yeah.
Here is how we release Merle from the kennel. Here is how I handle this with Merle.
That's awesome.
Which is,
that's invaluable.
Oh yeah, for sure. But the terrifying part is we're using the term started, and I think people have like a different perspective of that compared to like what Merle is. Merle was just allowed to be a bird dog for an entire season in some incredible landscapes in a lot of different scenarios on nothing but wild birds. She doesn't know what woe is. Like, I have just taught her heel. You know, she's not force broke.
She's not a finished dog. She's not a started dog.
She's just had a season under her belt just to like be a talented, which she is, bird dog. So it's not like Katie was like running her through all these drills. It's more like, utilize your natural instincts and your abilities and just go be a dog. And what I'm worried about is like, I'm going to see Katie this fall. Like, we're going to hunt together. And it's just like, oh, I hope she's not mad at me. Cause I know she wishes this one didn't get away. It's just like, oh, I hope that we're doing good enough to where Katie's pleased. But, in all seriousness, she just wanted a dog to be loved. And I think that's what really matters, because not every dog needs to be at a certain level. So while her dogs might be out there winning like NASTER events and things like that, Merle and I will get somewhere at some point.
I got to add Merle. It's got to be Merle Haggard, right?
I would assume so.
You didn't even ask.
Oh, I mean, that's the assumption. I mean, it's Merle the girl. I mean, I didn't name her, just like I didn't name Baxter, but it just... It fits, you know, it fits.
Well, I'm looking forward. Like, I asked a little bit ago if there's a signature memory you have with Bo. If for me, with Bo, I think it's the 25th anniversary project on a rooster road trip hunt.
Yeah, one of our original ones then.
Yeah, it was like year number two, maybe. Yeah. And Trammell was my original bird dog, and Trammell was having a good rooster road trip. I think it was actually year one. She was having a very good trip, put me in front of bird, and you got the first bird on that property with Bo, and you looked at me as like, gotcha, or something like that. You were so happy that...
Look at us, we're doing it!
I'd actually think I missed that bird, and you and Bo got it, and you're like, and then on the flip side with Baxter, I remember... I think it was right after we were walking through that field of kochia, and folks that follow Road Trip closely will remember you like
just throwing the kochia like in the air trying to get through.
So was that in Nebraska or Kansas?
I think it was Nebraska.
I think it was Nebraska too. And we got through that initial like just huge pile of kochia. You're like, where's Baxter? And you completely devolved. Do you remember this?
Vaguely, yes.
And you walked like a mile the other direction from the rest of the crew trying to find Baxter.
That dog was always a good laugh. And there's always a time.
Baxter was a great dog.
Oh, yeah. Part of me ragging on him is part of like our bit, you know. Yeah. It's just like that was just the relationship we had in terms of like, listen, neither of us here are all stars. We're not going to take ourselves seriously. Like, we're just the knuckleheads having fun.
Well, the other Pete one on the flip side of it was in Iowa. Baxter dug that crippled rooster that Nate shot on Rooster Road Trip about 2 years ago, and that bird would not have been found without Baxter.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the only like big finds I've seen of him. And like, have other people witness that, like, that just made me so happy. I mean, yeah. Like, but I've mentioned this, I think, in a previous podcast, like with relationships that are a bit more difficult than others here and there, the little wins you get feel that much better. Mm. And that keeps everything in perspective, because like, we were never limit chasing. Like, we were just good time chasing. And like, when we managed just to go on a solo hunt and come back with a bird, like, oh man, the satisfaction of the stoke was so damn high.
he was a cool dog. Well, I look forward to what the signature moment for Merle is going to be.
Merle's going to be a good one if I don't mess it up. That's where I'm at.
I'm sure he'll be fine. All right, we'll transition the conversation. We'll get Todd involved in just a moment. We'll talk weather and wildlife. Before we go there, I want to thank Purina Pro Plan. As I mentioned, they're the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast. They're also the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. All of my pups eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the wildlife habitat conservation mission of our organization, which is incredibly important to me and should be important to you, but the most important element is that Purina Pro Plan is a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. You can learn more at ProPlansport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. All right, second topic for today's episode I've called Weather and Wildlife. And once again, we'll go back to Andrew, but it doesn't start with weather or wildlife. It starts with downhill skiing.
Technically snowboarding, Bob.
Snowboarding.
Snowboarding.
Jeez, what was the term you threw out here that I didn't know?
Doxing?
Doxing. Okay, I don't know.
Now we know
about snowboarding. You know anything about snowboarding?
You know, I used to go downhill skiing a little bit.
I just said that too.
I was never a skier. I started snowboarding, although at my old age, I'm almost 40 now. I think I'm going to transition to skiing because it seems a bit more manageable as I age out of things. But yeah, I growing up, I was kind of like the typical millennial. I'm a skater boy. I have long hair, hemp necklace, like, love to skateboard.
See, that transitions. I grew up playing hockey. Yeah. I was on skates when I was 5 years old, right? So skis, that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. But I grew up on a skateboard, and I became a full-on just powder hound, because there was about 3 years in which my family lived in the Pacific Northwest. And that was a target-rich environment when it came to just superior snowboarding, skiing, huge jumps of snow. I mean, Mount Baker at that time was setting records for annual snowfall, and it was just...
And where is Mount Baker?
Just north of Seattle, closer to the Canadian border. Okay. But, like, being able to jump from Baker to Whistler, like, anybody who knows any of those terms knows what I'm talking about. And it's just, like... Life was good. so I just grew up obsessed with snowboarding in general. And all of that is predicated on snowfall, right? In terms of when you live in an area where you could theoretically go to four different resorts, where's the snowfall? What's the snowpack? What are the conditions? You can kind of pick and choose. So at an early age, like, I got good at reading the weather, and this was pre, like, the internet was still dialing up back then. Mm-hmm. So like this was before like everything was at your fingertips. Like, you watched the local weather, like, and you paid attention to it. So recently I was on Instagram and I saw a feed by, I think it was like Powder Hounds or Powder Chasers, Powder Magazine, something like that. I can't remember. But they had a really cool series of graphics where they're outlining like all the different regions that are like heavier for snowboarding and skiing, and the various snowfalls they had, like the snowpack levels, all of that. And I just like nerding out on it.
to be clear, you had no intention of going.
No.
You were just hungry for the information.
I'm a map guy. Like, it comes with canoe camping and all of that. Like, I just like maps. I like those types of visuals. I don't know what's up with my brain, but like, I'm just drawn to that. Mm-hmm. So I just find that information entertaining. And I was thinking, man, I wish there was something like this for like bird season. Not bird season, but like upland country in terms of, you know, we've been doing these habitat reports, and every once in a while, like, you see a big storm come through and you're like, oh man, like, I hope that didn't hammer the broods. But I was like, if we had something like that for all the different, like, specific regions within, like, what I'll say is, like, the upland country from southeast to southwest to the Great Plains to, you know, the sagebrush steppe, like, I'd be really interested in that in terms of, like, what just happened in these areas and how will that impact habitat growth, how will that impact, you know, the rearing of broods, and therefore what will the population look like later in the fall. I just thought that visually that'd be a fun way to kind of follow the season before the season. So then, of course, I had to reach out to you because, like, so Bob, you know any meteorologists? can we do something like this? And in typical Bob St. Pierre fashion, because you know everybody, you're like, well, matter of fact, I do.
I know a few meteorologists, but the first name that came to my mind was Todd. So
yeah,
thank you for being patient as we talk. So tell our listeners a little bit of the Todd Nelson biography, who you are, where you're from.
Well, so I'm originally born and raised in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities. I actually got my love and interest, you know, of weather when I was 8 years old. So my grandma and grandpa would take their pop-up camper to Lake Osakis. There's a place up there called Buck Point Lodge. I think ownership has changed hands, but it's still there. Fishing was great. My dad was a great fisherman. He'd outfish the guides that would always show up. And the guides would get mad when we'd show up with a full, you know, stringer. But, you know, it was my 8th birthday, and there was a line of thunderstorms coming in. And just got done with my dinner. My grandpa didn't feel right because we were in a pop-up camper. And so we went to bed, and he woke up and turned the radio on, and we were getting the alerts that there's, like, some nasty stuff coming in, like, get to safety now. And so he got us up, and at that moment, our camper started tipping over on two wheels.
Wow. Was it a tornado, straight-line winds?
I don't really know.
Okay.
But I'm thinking just straight-line winds. And so, you know, 8-year-old, right? I'm crying, trying to find my shoes. And my dad's, like, grabbing me by the, you know, sure, like, we got to get out of here, right? Camper's going to tip over. Step outside, hail, you know, hit me. And so we run to the main shelter, and my dad tried to shut the door behind us. It got ripped off.
Wow.
The hinges. And so we spent the rest of the evening and night in, you know, the bathrooms, which was kind of the main lodge. And so when we emerged, like, the next morning, it was, like, mayhem all over the place. Like, trees down, like, you know, most importantly, my birthday banners were shredded to pieces, right?
So was your birthday that night or the next morning?
It was, like, you know, that night or that day or whatever.
You were celebrating the week of birthday.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, naturally, like, a kid's going to get scared about weather, right? But it kind of drove me, like, you know, what is weather really? And so, you know, I'd always, like, watch the TV weather people, and, you know, Paul Douglas was, like, one of the greats when I was growing up. And so I just started watching him, and Ken Barlow, you know, he was my mentor growing up as well. And, you know, that's kind of the path that I wanted to take. I was like, you know what, I'm going to be a TV meteorologist. Like, it sounds so cool, right? And I just, you know, everything that happened weather-wise, it was like a severe weather, you know, outlook. I would always watch, like, TPT Channel 2 when they would run the old aviation, you know, weather maps and stuff. But I can still remember the old NOAA weather radio voice, right? You know, partly cloudy, and, you know, right? You remember that.
Oh, yeah.
So that was my gig, you know. I was dialed into the weather at a very young age. And, you know, it was like I when I graduated from high school, like, one of the ladies that knew me from way back then, she said I'd always like, check out this small weather book from the library. And she was, like, she worked at the school. So she ended up taking that book out of the library. And, you know, for my graduation present, she's, you know, filled out. I always knew you were going to be a weather, you know, weather person. So it's been in my blood, you know. So I got hooked up with Paul Douglas after I left Duluth. And I'd been in Duluth for 4 years. I was the chief at Fox 21 News. And I'll tell you what, like, Duluth is an amazing place, like, being just straight out of school because you're young, you don't care what you're making, like. And I love the outdoors. Mm-hmm. I would go up the North Shore like every weekend with my wife, and we would check out the South Shore. But, you know, talk about like microclimates within Duluth. Like, you know, the lake is like an average temperature of, you know, 40 degrees. And anything inland just outside of the Duluth Ring, you know, 70, 80 degrees. But, you know, in the spring, that wind comes roaring in and it is cold, mm-hmm. you know. Cooler by the lake is a real thing.
Oh, so help paint that picture for the folks at home that have no idea where Duluth is. Like where is Duluth and why?
Yeah,
is it so
unique? go up I-35 from the Twin Cities and you know, Lake Superior, the coldest, deepest lake out of the entire Great Lakes. It's right at the southwestern corner of the lake, and so it again the climate up there is super unique. You don't see this in too many places around the, you know, world. But the South Shore can get hit by lake effect snow. I mean, we're talking 30 to 1 ratios. And as you were talking about, you know, out in the Northwest, well, you know, like the UP of Michigan and
Mount Bohemia, baby.
Oh man, it is crazy. But
say yonder, yeah, real fine.
There you go. Well, you're from the UP.
Yeah.
You know, so then you talk about like the North Shore and the lake enhancement that can happen there, and you know, up by Lutz and Grand Marais, two harbors, they can just get smoked by huge events. So, you know, living up there and being a part of like some of the greatest snowstorms that I've ever witnessed in my entire life, I was there for it, right? But then you fast forward, you know, a few years, and I moved down here and got hooked up with Paul Douglas, and at that point we were called Weather Nation. And so we were mainly focused on TV weather and broadcasting for TV stations. We actually launched on DirecTV, and we were live there for a while. Weather Nation actually moved out to Denver, and all of us within this company, we had a chance to go out to Denver. And I'm like, gosh, why would I move to Denver? Like, I'm sure it's a sweet place, right? But I have family here. I, you know, I love hunting. I love fishing. I love, you know, just everything that embodies Minnesota. Like, that's me, you know, and I speak like a Minnesotan too. So I just really had no intentions on leaving. And, you know, it's just we rebranded ourselves as Predictix. And so not only do we still have a number of, you know, broadcast clients from, you know, actual television stations, to running our own Caribbean weather channel. Like, you know, one of my colleagues and I, we just went down to the Bahamas for a hurricane conference a few years ago. So that was cool. But, you know, PBS stations around the country, you know, websites. So that's kind of one bucket. Another bucket is, you know, doing stuff with consulting work. We actually work with Minneapolis Airport and we're contract to be there helping out with snowfall events. And then, of course, you know, like Pheasants Forever, you know, like this is probably one of the most unique relationships that I've, you know, ever been a part of, because it's not necessarily what you would think of, like I need a daily weather report or I need to know if there's going to be, you know, lightning in my area. It's, you know, like as you and I were talking, this is going to be kind of an interesting, you know, learned relationship as we go. And, you know, what impacts, you know, your world in the weather. Like I know where the bodies are buried. I can, I can figure out the maps, you know,
forensic meteorology.
Yes. Yeah.
There was exactly a phrase we learned in the last month.
Yeah.
Forensic, yep, meteorology.
Yep. And so our team here at Predictix is really good at, you know, coming up with maps, creating maps, finding the information, and then, tailoring it to our specific clients and, you know, being, you know, linked with you guys. Like I've already learned so much from you, Bob, just, and again, I'm a hunter. Like, I grew up not really hunting because I was so focused on sports. Like I played hockey and baseball, and you know, if anybody out there is a, you know, full-time hockey and baseball player, like, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Like hunting, you know, good luck, you know, good luck trying to find time for that. So, I'm just lucky that I can deer hunt a couple of, you know, times a year. Like I go to the Minnesota opener at our family's, land in Parker's Prairie. And then, we own land in Wisconsin. So I get to do that as well. And I'm just very fortunate that I've been able to hunt with, you know, my family. Mm-hmm. My dad has, you know, been gone since 2010, so never really got a chance to hunt with him. He was a great fisherman. I never really got introduced to the bird hunting, just because I never had the time. We never had dogs around the house. And so that was kind of a sad thing to me, because I was like, man, if I could do any hunting, it would be pheasants for sure. Because A, you don't have to wake up at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning to get to the deer stand. Like, you can wait till it's light. And, so yeah, but that's,
well, you know, a guy.
I know a guy, so, and I've been trying to get.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned baseball. I want to just touch on mm-hmm. that too, because that's how we intersected.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So again, as a lover of everything outdoors and hunting and fishing, and you know, just you know, I listened to you on KFAN, and so love the show, and so every once in a while you talk something about weather, and I'm like, is this going to be weird for me to like send Bob a Twitter message that, like, you know, we got, you know, 15 inches of snow and, you know, and this set a record for XYZ. And so then you said, thank you. And you actually brought it up on air. And so I think that's kind of originally how, you know, our relationship started. But, so I've been a part-time meteorologist at the Minnesota Twins now for 10 years. So I generally work, on site every Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And we have another meteorologist, Mace Michaels, who I'm sure a lot of listeners from the Twin Cities know of. Great Matt. And so he works Monday through Thursday. But I know when you and I were talking, there was a Pheasants Forever deal at the Twins, which I thought was really cool. And so I reached out and I said, hey, if you're going to be there, you know, just swing on down to the weather office and I'll, you know, show you what I do and get you on the field before the game. And, you know, that was, you know, a handful of years ago.
Yeah, that was
now,
like
but...
five. And it makes sense, too. I mean, mm-hmm. having worked in baseball, a rainout is like millions of dollars in loss.
Yeah.
Because all those tickets, you got to find a different game for. You lose all the hot dog sales. Yeah. Right? So to have a, in the minor leagues where I worked, we didn't have our own meteorologist. But, I mean, a pro team having their own meteorologist that sits behind home plate, you know, rather than letting the umpires make the decision, they can't even call the right strike, right? Yeah. Like, you have a meteorologist like, well, this rainstorm, thunderstorm, whatever, it's going to go around us. And having that level of weather dialed in makes a big deal.
It does make a big deal. You know, it's interesting. MLB as a whole contracts with a group that, you know, sits in an office, and then any game that's ongoing can call up this specific office and ask a Matt, like, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of this game and that game and this game? But, you know, those games could go on forever. Now, the Minnesota Twins are the only team in MLB that actually has a meteorologist on site.
Is that right?
It is. Huh. And so I have to, you know, give kudos to one of my other mentors growing up here in the Twin Cities, Craig Edwards. He used to be the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service here in the Twin Cities. And so when he retired, you know, I knew him from when I was in high school, and being, you know, like, I'm going to be a weather guy, like, I'd always tap him on the shoulder when I would go to the Twins game, you know, like, hey, Craig, can I come down and see the weather office? And he was such a great guy and let me in there. But he was the guy that called up the Twins and he said, I think you guys would benefit from having a Met on staff. And so they were like, okay, well, sure, we got an office here. I mean, we can throw out a computer in there. And you know, one thing led after the other, and, you know, Craig was the guy, so.
So if the Twins win the World Series, and that's a big if, would you get a ring?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe if I forecasted, like, every weather event, right, you know.
We'll send out an action alert on your behalf.
Yeah.
All right, so let's pass the baton back to Andrew now. So we've got a meteorologist that can do forensic meteorology and also forecasts. Now, we did our first one June 30th, but going forward, what's your vision for how this plays out over the next year?
I just want to see quick, digestible, informative graphics and text that give people a snapshot of like significant events that have happened throughout pheasant and quail country. Because a lot of us travel quite a bit. And I, over the past half decade or so, I think a lot of us are traveling more. Mm-hmm. I think that the demographics of the upland hunter are actually shifting. Mm. It used to be same spots, same people, block here, stand there, walk that field that direction, then we're gonna go walk here, and we're gonna walk. It's like the same routine over and over. I feel like that's aging out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're seeing are people more willing to travel further, A, because sometimes they have to, mm-hmm. and B, because there's some like wanderlust and there's adventure. Like some adventure, and like that's an important component of this, because it's more than just getting birds. Because if it was just about putting meat in the freezer, like this is a negative calorie event. Mm-hmm. So like, let's be real. It's not like putting a deer in the freezer. Like there's more inherently to it that brings about satisfaction.
It's kind of the Instagram effect too. It's like, wow, look at how beautiful that is. I want to go there.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like you realize there's pockets in the entire country that have publicly accessible acres that are beautiful, and like they're unique and they're different, and like, let's go camp out. Let's go find a CB hotel and experience a different dive bar and then go run the dogs. You know, there's a lot to be done, but I think this could open up eyeballs to like where different locations are in terms of where you could go, and also what happened, right? Like this little 20 mile by 20 mile section got absolutely hammered by hail, mm-hmm. you know, mid June. Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. Or this section has seen like ideal rainfall, warm temperatures, beautiful habitat, like perfect for broods and forbs and everything to grow together. So it's informative, but it's also kind of expands people's vision of like what is really like our upland landscape, so that you start thinking beyond your own back 40. Plus I just like cool visuals and maps, so I just wanted to get that out there.
Anything you want to add to that, Tyler, that you're thinking about as you learn, like you mentioned, learning from us, the conservation world and the bird world?
Well, again, not necessarily knowing the bird world, like the conversation that we had, you know, the ideal window for, you know, the new, the brooding and the nesting, you know, being in that mid-June window, like.
For pheasant,
yeah. You know, I didn't know that, you know. But what I can tell you is that we had, you know, a ton of rain in west central Minnesota, and temperatures during that time period were significantly colder than they should have been. In fact, Minneapolis had a daytime high sub 60 degrees for the first time in like 14 years. So that's the knowledge that I bring to the table. But you telling me like this type of weather significantly impacts.
Right, or monsoons.
Correct, the gully washers, right, yeah. You know, the drought, like, you know, if we have an extended drought and dry weather in the Southwest, like, you don't have, you know, the adequate number of insects. So, you know, I know how dry it's been over the last 30 to 60 days. I can give you that information, you know, in a nice graphical way, but with some nuggets that, you know, you and your team can throw out to, you know, enlighten, you know, everybody that follows you, you know. To me, it makes complete sense. So your original idea, Andrew, was great.
Yeah, and I think you touched on an important word there in, like, team. So, I mean, for those at home, it's not just, like, Bob and I or editors trying to suss out, like, well, what does this mean, mm-hmm. right? I'm a comm major at most, right? So we're taking all the information, the graphics that Todd's team is producing, and then we're having a couple key biologists,
our science team
translate that mm-hmm. in terms of, okay, so what do these events in these locations actually mean for the birds that are on the ground or the birds that could potentially be on the ground?
Yeah.
And then we just kind of marry it all together, and hopefully people are willing to swipe through some carousels on Instagram and look at some photos and graphics and on Facebook and Twitter and learn something.
Yeah. Learn something. And that's what we're doing here too. So I'll invite our listeners. We're learning what you want too. You know, we have this incredible, powerful tool in Todd. Have you ever called a tool before?
Well, not in that way. But.
But, you know, whether it's hurricanes or hail, right?
Yep.
Temperature, humidity,
Dew points.
Rain, snow, snow depth, length, duration of snow on the ground, or the absence of anything. You talked about drought. We have the ability to capture that and create maps around it. What we're wrestling with for listeners, you know, invite your input. You know, how much do you want to look back, forensic science, about how good habitat conditions were during nesting season, brood season, versus looking forward for hunting opener season, is this weekend, and this is what the weather looks like. My assumption is everybody's going to do that locally on weather.com or wherever, right? And there's probably more value to the forensic weather, looking back and being able to tell what the birds have experienced. But that's what we want to know from our listeners. Tell us, you know, things that you're hungry for about the intersection between weather, habitat, and wildlife.
And I think, you know, I mean, it's pretty easy to like say, oh yeah, well, hey, we had, you know, XYZ number of rain events in this area, but we have a great team here at Predictix, and like, in a sense, it's almost like I kind of want to get challenged, you know, like, is there like just an abstract thing that impacts, you know, what you do in the field and how that's going to impact birds? Doesn't matter where it is in the country. Like, you know, let's see if we can figure that out.
Yeah.
You know, if there's just a burning question that somebody has had for years, you know, let's go for it.
All six species of quail and pheasants all on the table, geography of the entire country.
Yep.
Is all available to us.
Yeah.
So if you got a question about weather that you want to see in map form, let us know. BobS@pheasantsforever.org and let me know, and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking to do this in a monthly cadence. So think about if you had a monthly bird habitat centric forecast, what information would you want there? Should be fun. I hope people like it.
Yeah, there's some obvious ones, right? Nesting season, temperature and rainfall, and, you know, in winter, how much snow is on the ground and how long is the winter, and how, you know, how is that impacting adult carryover? I mentioned monsoon season in the Southwest and how that impacts, you know, Mearns quail. And there's just some obvious things, but we want
to. Yeah. Well, you've been throwing a lot of cool species to me, like the bobwhite down in the Southeast. You know, that's cool. Like I had no clue that there's this many, you know, different species. So
buckle up, Tom.
Yeah, I know. I'm excited. Well, yeah. And I had told you too, Bob, like, you know, just for me to get a better understanding of, you know, how the weather impacts your guys' world. Like, you know, I mean, I go for hikes, but, you know, I don't necessarily go for hikes in the prairie, and I'm kind of excited to do that. I mean, I just drove, you know, 400 miles across South Dakota to the Black Hills this last week to, you know, for a family vacation.
How many pheasants did you see?
Not too many. You know, a lot of prairie dogs. But
they were sitting on nests still probably while you're driving through.
Sure, yeah. A lot of interstate driving.
Yeah.
So.
All right. You know, one thing that happened, so I'll transition for the third time, third topic. Folks are probably catching on to a lot of new things happen the beginning of July for us, and people are probably scratching their head. Why is that? Well, that's our fiscal year. That's when a new year starts at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And the big splashy new thing Andrew was also in charge of, a brand new, a rebranding of the organization. Maybe you've given this presentation about why and how, probably no less than 36 times.
You're just outing me here. Now everyone knows where to send the hate mail.
Well, they have my email, bobassetpheasantsforever.org. But
now you got to dox him.
Yeah, dox him.
He just did. That's what happened. He outed me.
Tell us about the why.
As a few of us have been known to say lately, it was 43 years in the making, really. Pheasants Forever's very first logo, for being technical, was more of like a MS paint job that was on top of like a newspaper type publication.
1982.
Yep. The what we're referring to as the Legacy logo, which is the Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, full color logos in the silo shape. That actually started as a scan painting on the Pheasants Forever side of things, and then we just tried to mirror that look on Quail Forever. You know, 20 going on 21 years ago at this point. That logo means a lot. And it means a lot to a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. Tattoos.
So this change is not insignificant. Mm-hmm. We're not doing this in a flippant way. There's a lot of stories. There's a lot of legacies. There's tombstones. There's four decades of hard work, of blood, sweat, and tears towards our conservation mission going underneath that banner. Mm-hmm. So this was not a decision that we took lightly. But we felt like it was a decision that had to be made. The logos just weren't working anymore. The world had grown up around us, and the environments in which the logos and the branding needed to be representative of not only us, but our volunteers and the work we do and the conservation that it represents, they literally weren't working. That you couldn't scale them up and down. They had the script font with like the normal typewriter font, like 20 different colors in one logo. No embroidery looked the same. Chapters stopped using our logos on their own materials and created their own because our logos just weren't working mm-hmm. for them.
Digitally.
Our brand equity overall was just starting to plummet because we had to make one-off logos for everything we did just to fit in different environments or different programs. And people weren't even recognizing all the good stuff that we as an organization were doing because our logos weren't being seen in the environments in which we were doing those work, all that work. So I started down this journey about 3 years ago, just making a presentation and more of an impassioned plea to our national board of directors for permission to pursue a refreshed brand identity for both Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. We put a lot of work into it, and a lot of people are thinking, well, how many millions of dollars did you put into that? And you didn't put that in the habitat, did you? Well, rest assured, we're the most frugal nonprofit you're going to meet. Luckily, at that time, Matt Kaharski was our chairman of the board, and he put us in contact with Joe Smith, which is one of the leading branding consultant agencies in the country. And they did a lot of guidance for us and with us pro bono.
Means for free.
So we had expertise without having to pay for it, but our own internal team was hand on the steering wheel. Mm-hmm. We weren't going to lose sight of our voice, our members, and who we are. And we worked with chapter volunteers in terms of, what are the current pain points? What are we trying to solve to? What do we aspire to be? Who do we want to talk to? That's why there's a hen on the logo now. So we involved all these different people over a long period of time to make sure that we got it right. And we did it in a way that will have longevity and be clear as day to anybody who sees any of our suite of logos, what chapters doing that work, what organizations behind that work, and who can they support to do more of it. So we have new primary icons. It's got the Flushing Birds and the name below it, and the Pheasants Forever version has like a spur sticking out of the P, and the Quail Forever has a feather in the Q, just nice beautiful little touches. Mm-hmm. Right, and the serif fonts have like wingtips on them that match the wingtips and the logo is like, there's a shared wing in the middle of each logo that kind of shares like the unity of like us with our volunteers and partners and members and donors. And in certain situations where the brands need to come together, like Pheasant Fest, well, you can merge the Quail Forever and the Pheasants Forever logos together. And that shared wing just cements that unity in terms of like protecting upland landscapes across the entire country, while recognizing that there are different groups of people in different chapters focused on different landscapes for different birds, and they need to be able to stand on their own for Quail Forever specifically. Because part of this exercise, I also want to double down on the fact that there are just as many Quail Forever biologists out there as there are Pheasants Forever. Quail Forever needs to fly. It needs to stand on its own. It's not just Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever all the time. Like, Quail Forever specifically is doing so much amazing work and can do so much more incredible work this is a great catalyst to kind of start carving out different voices for both organizations. So there's a lot of good that can come from this beyond just being able to populate, you know, a pin and an Onyx map with a PF, like an official PF that people know what that is, or updating like a social media profile image, or whether it's letterhead or banners. Like, we can scale up, scale down, and everything is going to be consistent and unified, because one thing that we're proud of being is we produce local results like no other group, but we also have an incredibly powerful national voice, and we all need to be under like the same banner. Like, with all the public land stuff we just saw going on, why'd that stop? Because everybody was flying under the same banner. We need to be able to do that in the upland space too. And so, like, let's cut it out. Let's get rid of the logo vomit that's all over the place. let's clean things up, and let's be proud of who we are.
Yeah.
And I know there are critics. There's always critics. Like, I've been watching brands refresh, rebrand, roll stuff out for the past 2 years, just like watching how things happen. And nobody's ever happy with change. Like, let's just be real. Like, I knew we were going to get comments no matter what we did. But I've actually been pleasantly surprised with how positive a lot of the feedback has been in terms of people seeing the why and the need for it. And like, the first time you see it on a hat or a sweatshirt, it's just like, oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Like
particularly blaze orange.
Yeah.
Which has just been a struggle.
So yeah, now we have a single color logo that can adapt and look good on any sort of background. It can fit in anything. And people are excited about that. And on the flip side, there's people upset about you're leaving your legacy behind. I'm doubling down on the fact that no, we're not. We're not burying our old selves. We're not burying our legacy. Like, we're building on it. We're taking flight from it. Like, our silo logos are never going to always completely go away. So here's some insider baseball for folks, because you like to talk baseball, right? For trademark purposes, we have to have that logo in use here and there. So it's not like we're just forgetting our past. If we were to look over the fence at other groups, look what DU does with their shield. They have their duck head and they have their shield. Like, sometime in the future, we'll do retro stuff with our old legacy logo. Like, it's still who we are. Like, at our core, we're still the same. But outwardly facing, we needed a new look. And so,
I love when you tell the story of the chapter volunteer in Nevada. Because, you know, that's been one of the criticisms. Why weren't members involved? Well, actually, they were. We couldn't let everybody know, but you...
Yeah, we had chapters and chapter leaders that were representative of every single landscape, a part of this process, from here's our why. Like, this is what we think. Is that, like, what problems are you having? Like, trying to validate. Like, we're not crazy here, right? Like, our current logos are, like, driving us all nuts. It's like, that was a, like, resounding yes. You know, the chapter leader that you're speaking to is like, yeah, we stopped using your stuff. We created our own, and we actually like ours more. So we don't even, like, shop at the official store anymore. We just outsource everything. It's like, that's a problem. Like, that is a problem, like, for our organization. From there, it's like we showed them sketches, and we got feedback, and then we reworked things. And, like, so we brought our volunteer, like, the core of who we are. We brought them along, but not every member is going to get the vote on this. Like, that's just the reality of it. And people need to understand that. It's like, well, why weren't members involved? We wish we could involve every single member, but that's exactly how you don't get anything done. So we had to make some tough decisions, and we had to be bold, and we had to take a risk and just say, no, the time is now. We need to do this. And here we go. Buckle up. And in terms of, like, here we go, to speak to, like, how we're rolling things out and how frugal we are, this is a phased, prolonged rollout. We're not asking anybody, nor are we telling people, nor do we want people to go rewrap your chapter trailer for $40,000 because we've got a new logo. That's wildly inappropriate. It's when things phase out or get beaten up or need to be replaced, just make sure the new branding's on there. Like, it's phasing stuff out and replacing with what's new, because we want to be responsible and respectful of all the fundraising dollars that our chapters make, that they get to decide what they get to do with that. I don't want that going to a rebrand. That's not why I work here. I'm the marketing guy. I love logos, right? But, like, that's not where I want those chapter dollars going.
Right.
So, like, stick to the mission. But when you need to replace things, when that banner needs to be updated, use that new logo. Let's do it. Digitally, obviously, totally different story. Like, we can start refreshing websites and all of that, like, with minimal cost, and we have. So, yeah, if you go to pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org/brand, you'll hit a landing page that specifically walks you through our why, what these logos look like, why we did this, and what you can expect into the future. Don't get hung up on the quote-unquote new websites. Those aren't our new websites. We just refreshed websites we have, and to let a cat out of a bag, I'm also working on actual new websites that people actually enjoy being able to use, both on desktop and mobile. They're going to be great. Look for that end of 2025, early 2026.
So you got a three-year-old, a new dog. You just finished refreshing the brand.
Yeah.
Sorry, wrong terminology. Got a new website coming up.
Don't tell me to do anything more. Oh, we got to figure out where we're going for a road trip. No, but it's all super exciting stuff.
It is.
But it's all change, and change is hard, and I'm giving people the grace to take time warming up to it, because I think they will. For those of you that need that time, some of you are hooting and hollering and loving it, and I love the feedback. And again, seeing what's happened to other orgs in our niche and outside of it, it can get pretty ruthless, and I gotta say that our core supporters and members have sent a lot of positive feedback, which allowed my anxiety to like subdue a little quicker than I even thought it would.
If folks are looking for kind of a visual representation of like what we're hoping this means in the future, just go to the Shield store and look at the orange. You can pick your choice: Pheasants Forever or Quail Forever orange hoodie, right? It's the sharpest looking thing. It's probably already sold out, but it's the sharpest looking thing. That first time, it's just been so hard to put the Pheasants Forever logo in a good way on Blaze Orange, because you've talked about, you know, the indigo bunting blue and the canary yellow, like just vendors trying to match a scanned painting over the last 40 years.
Half of them looked like the PF versions looked like weird parrots and the QF version looked like a mushy bowl of oatmeal. Like it was just really hard to get right. So now we have monograms and bold word marks, and we have horizontal layouts. We have primary icons.
It looks
and
good on a pocket knife, which has never happened.
Yeah, it's just now we can really fly forward, and I'm excited about it. But I completely respect the fact that, there's people out there that have our logo tattooed on their body. Yeah. And that we took this seriously, but we're not changing who we are. We're not turning our back on our legacy, nor our legacy logo. It's always going to be at our core.
Yeah. Right on. Nice job. It looked great. Pheasantsforever.org, quailforever.org/brand. All right, we'll go around the horn. We covered our three topics in Dan Patrick form, which is not something I've done on a podcast before. I'll ask you what we learned today. It is pretty obvious what I learned today. I learned about a new term, two new terms.
Yep.
A MET, which is a meteorologist.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
You know, it's just a mouthful.
Meteorologist.
Yeah. It's just easier to say MET.
And from Andrew, I learned doxing.
Doxing. D-O-X-I-N-G. Don't want to dox anyone.
Doxing. Had you known doxing?
No, I didn't.
So you learned doxing. I learned. What else did you learn today?
I learned that Andrew got a new puppy, today, and he's got a kid, and, he's doing well. He's got a busy lifestyle. Yeah. So I learned that. I'm really excited for this relationship with you guys, and I'm excited to learn more about, your Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, lifestyle and the people that you serve, it's awesome. And it actually makes me want to get into doing what you guys do more, out in the field. So that's cool to me.
For folks that missed the first weather and wildlife, kind of the visualization of this relationship, look to June 30th on our blog, pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org. There's a blog. It was also on all of our social posts June 30th, and you can see the first iteration, but there'll be at least one a month coming, including video.
Including video, yeah.
So you'll get to see Todd's face on video, too. All right, Andrew, you get to put a bow on this. What did you learn today?
I learned that I think we're just scratching the surface with what we can do with Todd's team. Having done the tour and learning what he's doing with other clients in a variety of different spaces, it's got my gears turning. I mean, they're a little rusty and slow per usual, but they're turning. like the correlation between like temperature and precipitation, how's that line up with population? Like, what if we like cracked like some code? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I'm super curious to hear what our listeners are interested in. And there's probably like some dog centric stuff too, in terms of, I'm immediately after this, I'm going to be driving appropriate speeds to dog training, right?
Yeah. But it's Wednesday night dog training.
It's 80 degrees out. Mm-hmm. And, I tried to sneak her out a little bit yesterday. And it's like, we've made it like maybe a mile. I was like, yeah, this is a stupid idea. Like, what are the thresholds in terms of like how dew point actually affects like how comfortable or how safe things are versus like just humidity levels and temperature indexes?
Or is there a combo?
Like, how does that work for like dogs specifically? Like, the weather controls everything. I mean, we love to say, we can control habitat, but we can't control Mother Nature. Well, it's like, let's acknowledge like the elephant in the room, which is Mother Nature, in terms of like impacting everything we do and every aspect of our life. So keying in on that and embracing it and trying to learn from it, or at least get ahead of it or learn from the past. It's just a really fun new kind of adventure for us.
Cool.
Bob S. at pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org. Let us know what you want to see out of the weather. And if you want to learn a little bit more about Predictix,
that's a mouthful.
You got to be careful with that one. PREDICTIX.com.
Correct.
We'll link it in the notes.
Yeah. Well, there's a good, that's a good point. I'm used to doing live radio, apparently. All right, folks. Thank you for coming along for this conversation about Merle, the started bird dog, weather and wildlife, and the refresh brands of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. I'm Bob St. Pierre, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.